Welcome to episode 90 of the Payers and Players podcast. We're excited about a great episode. We've got an expert with us today. Scott, do you want to introduce our expert?
Absolutely. It's Dr. Nehru Jayanthi. He leads Emory's tennis medicine program, and he's the director of the Emory Sports Medicine Research and Education Foundation and co-directs Emory's Youth Sports Medicine Program. He's consulted on multiple sports, but he's primarily, I think, a tennis expert, and we're happy to have him on the show to discuss some topics that are probably very relevant to all the players out there.
Yeah, before we dive into the questions, we've got three topics we're going to try to go fast in. His time's valuable, so we're going to get into injury prevention and rehab and prehab, nutrition and physical fitness. Before we dive in, we've done an initial podcast with Dr. Ben Kibler on some of the basics of tennis injury prevention and best practices. Dr. Jayanthi's also done many episodes with Lisa Stone on the Parenting Aces podcast and many others. So if you want to see some of his research, you can go and get some of that information. But today we're going to dive real deep into those specific areas. And we're also going to ask some of the listeners questions who responded on Twitter. So with that, Dr. Jayanthi, thank you for joining us.
Well, absolutely. Thanks for having me. And, you know, it's always great to be able to try to reach out to parents and coaches that are on. Another resource is I was on two USTA national webinars on load management back-to-back last couple months. I think they're publicly available as well, too. And we have a couple of PowerPoints, and they review some of kind of USTA recommendations on training and competition loads. And I think a lot of parents are interested. But maybe most importantly, I'm also the father of two young budding multi-sport, athletes and tennis players and actors. My older one's an actor. So so I think I can kind of comment from personal experience on the early side of this fun process as well.
One of the things that we're concerned about is overuse. Are you concerned about overacting with your son?
Well, you know, it's actually a really good question. Yesterday alone, he had a callback for a commercial right after his during the day, he had two performances for his chorus, then a callback for a commercial. Then he had a Stranger Things audition. And then now he's got a callback for the lead, you know, in his school play today. So there is a bit of overuse in acting there. You're right, actually. This is and the actor strike just ended, so everything's kind of coming at once.
Okay, good.
Gotcha. Well, and one of my favorite Facebook posts you put out a while back when they were younger is one of them had a shirt on that said, "I'm told I like tennis." So I thought that was a great t-shirt.
Yeah, that was when they were a baby. But I think my first birthday, I got him a shirt that, you know, when a seven-year-old birthday, it said, you know, perfect day. It said, wake up, play tennis, eat lunch, play tennis, you know, go to sleep, you know, have dinner, play tennis. So I love tennis too, and that'd be my perfect day. But we have to be kind of mindful, about where we can run a little trouble. So I think that's what this is about.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons one of the things I like about you so much, your general orthopedic person is going to go right into kids shouldn't play that much, but I think you understand. Are you a 4-5 player now?
5-0, still 5-0, 15-1-year-old 5-0. So,
nice. So a player
hard to find those.
The medical and the tennis side. So we're excited to have you on. So let's dive right in. But before we do, will you tell people what you're doing in Major League Baseball?
I just help out a little bit with the Braves organization and, you know, wherever I can. We just had some MLB winter meetings and, you know, talked a little bit about international travel and, do some physicals, help out whenever there's some issues. So, you know, like Scott said, I do a lot of sports. And for the other sport, I get typecast and I'm just a tennis guy. I can't even pretend that tennis isn't my number one. It's absolutely where my heart is. But, for youth sport, actually research and treat just about every sport and also help at kind of every level of athletics. But, you know, even with all that, I minimize it because honestly, my heart's still into the young athlete. I think that's where most of it is. That's where we have thousands and thousands. That's where the most people need the help.
Yeah. That sounds great. Well, I know the listeners will be excited about that. So let me dive into question number one. So a lot of folks are, and you've got some of the guidelines around how many hours per week a player should be playing. And you've talked a lot about the age hour rule. So will you talk for a second, what is the age hour rule? And then the second part to that is, you know, some academies will go Monday through Friday and then have Saturday, Sunday off. Some will do Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. Do you think it's better to have two consecutive days off, or is 2 days 2 days, regardless if it's one day and another day of tennis? Give us your opinion on the age hour rule and then those two consecutive days off in a week.
Great questions. And these came up. We actually had a load webinar with USTA, about 500 parents were on. And as soon as it was done, you know, Carl Davies messaged me that day and said, the parents want more. So we literally set it up for the next month, because it was more than just like here at General Rep. They wanted exactly what you're talking about. And so, you know, if we back up, what we're also talking about, we have to be even more specific. And I think that's what you want, be as specific. So you look at the stage of development. That's where I'm, that's where a lot of our research is right now. And there's three stages, right? So when you are pre-adolescent, when you have not hit your big growth spurt, typically for girls, that's probably, you know, under 11. Boys, it's actually under 13. So, and some are even 13 and still pre-adolescent. Let's say it's like up to 12U, certainly for most players, that's a different set of rules. And so let's start with that. And that group, that's where we really hope that you are trying, you know, other sports that you, you know, we want you to train. If you want to be a performance, we have to talk about this high performance, you know, tennis, but we want you to still love it and not get, you know, siphoned off, because a lot of kids quit at even 12U. You lose about a third every 12U, 14U, 16U. So my biggest goal, even my 8-year-old, you know, is for him not to want to stop playing. So that's where you have to get regular measurements. So I wouldn't use age hours rule, in my opinion, in organized tennis for the 12 and under, personally. I think you have to be a little, for most kids, there's a few resilient ones, but for most kids. And so, you know, I think we have to, I'm trying to restart my video there because I think I froze there. Yeah. And so, you know, and part of it is to allow other activities during the week. So, you know, if you're 10, 12 years old, and most kids, you know, you get out there 2-3 times a week on alternate days, it keeps the variety too. And they don't get bored. And it is somewhat of a vulnerable period, but most kids in that area don't get the serious overuse injuries. So we're okay with a lot of what we call free play. You want to go hit with your friends. You want to hit with your parents. That's very different. That's when you're like, hey, I'm tired. I stop. I almost don't even want to count that. What I'm talking about is amount of organized tennis with coaching and drills and match play and all that kind of stuff, okay? So then separate to that, if we move on to the peak height velocity, which is when you get your rapid growth. So that's about 11 years old to maybe 14 for girls and about 13 to 16 for boys, maybe 15 or 16. And so in that group, you start escalating, and I get it. You have to, in order to perform, you start picking up your volume. And yeah, you still, that's when, if you were a 12 or 13 year old, we want to train less hours per week than that age. So 12 or 13 hours or less. We know that if you increase it, you're more likely to get serious overuse injury. So, and that's fine. Now I will say it's about what you're doing. And that's part of what you'll talk about with injury prevention here. But so if you're doing mostly match play and a lot of point play with a lot of rapid directional change and movement and a lot of competitive stuff, more than 50%, that's our 1-to-1 ratio, those kids are more vulnerable. Not all of them get hurt, but they're more vulnerable because they're going through the rapid growth. Now you can start getting a little bit more into serious overuse injuries, low back stress injuries, growth plate stress injuries, elbow, shoulder, other areas. And so, you know, every kid's different. Some kids are, again, resilient, and you'll watch the kid who's like, how is this kid training full time, never gets hurt? We're going to study that group. Actually, we've always studied the injured group. We're actually, one of our next studies looking at resilience and why are some kids resilient. I think it's some of the stuff you're talking about, the biomechanics of their body, and when you apply the load. So, but in general, you have to be cautious with that group. So if you don't tolerate it, if your child doesn't tolerate it, and you're going through, and you're like, hey, they're doing 10 hours, 12 hours. It's a type of injury. If they have a low, like, hey, the muscles, you know, like a little quad soreness, kneecap pain, they don't have to make big changes and they go on. That's not what I'm talking about. But if they've had one of those kind of overuse injuries that kept them out for a month or, you know, longer, I think you have to readjust that schedule and recognize that they're in this peak height velocity. And I know most doctors, you know, in fact, some very good doctors, most of them are not necessarily calculating out where you're going to be and what your growth rate is, all that kind of stuff that we kind of tend to look at. But at least get a sense of that, you know, when you're, if you have to visit with someone. Then finally you ramp up, right? You're skeletally mature, 13 years old, 14 years old for a girl, and maybe for a boy, 15 or so. And then, you know, how much you ramp up is really between you and your coach. But, you know, we're finding that about up to 16 hours a week. And beyond that, people tend to have a big, significant, like a really ramp up in their injury risk. So if you get to about 16, that's about 3 hours a day, you know, about 5 days a week. You know, and then, but then in that group, about half your time should be on match play and point play, your competition to training ratio. That's in, including like your tournaments and what you're doing in practice. So you go to a high performance company. Like I went and stopped by one the other day and, you know, I was looking for some hitting and then they're like, we're doing match play. Well, they were all in that group. And so, you know, they threw me out there with some nationally ranked junior. I was like, man, I haven't played singles in a while, but that's what they should be doing. You should be doing about half of his match play in that group. But I don't know, like my, you know, my little guy, it was fun because they've not done that at all. And then, these are high performance academies. And he just did a little Davis Cup the first time he's been there. And he's been there for about 3-4 months. And they just did a couple of like quick sets, but they hadn't done any of that. So most of that is not match play. So it's what you're doing. And that last kind of stage when you're skeletally mature, you know, and you're older, yeah, you can go at a hard, that's when you go at it hard and figure out how close to your peak you can get. So it very, and as you know, Robert, you know, it's very different based on where you are in your development.
So what about the, during the week, 5 days and 2 days off, or should they take a day off in the middle of that and just take 2 days anywhere in the week?
Yeah. You know, so, you know, it probably doesn't make a huge difference as long as if we're talking an uninjured kid, it probably doesn't make a huge difference. When it depends what you have. If you have a bone stress injury, I like 1 day on, 1 day off when we return. We do a lot of return to play in that way. Without injury, yeah, 1 or 2 days off each week, wherever you do it is probably reasonable, you know. And so, and then Mark Kovacs had some data, and I, you might have talked to Mark Kovacs before about that itself as well. And we're finding that, you know, 1 to 2 days is a good, and this is, again, that last group, that skeletally mature, that really high performance group. But pre-adolescent, you know, I don't know if they should be doing more than 3 days a week. You know, that's just, and again, that's maybe some coaches don't get mad at me, but, you know, I'm not sure if most kids are prepared for that. And what I'm not looking at just performance. I don't want these kids to quit. And the best way to keep them is to have them still want it. They want to be hungry and love it and not overflood them. And just all of a sudden they're like 14, like, I want to see my friends. So aside from injury alone.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about how that may be at odds with the short-term athletic development? I know something you've talked a lot about, and it's sort of one of these things where the data maybe is going against what we were preaching in terms of.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
No, it's a great point. And, you know, I'm not here to judge. Like, I get it. Like, every family has a different goal. And, you know, long-term athletic development model has been around for a long time. The Canadians invented it. The Americans, we feel like, you know, we want to say it's ours, but it was talked about many years, you know, before we really, you know, got into that. And that's really having a strategy that gets young athletes to perform at their peak when we want them to really peak, which is later in life. You know, so when you have an 8-year-old, I think of it as a 10-year process to get them to be 18 and be kind of close to their best, right? And even beyond that. And but that takes a lot of patience, multi-sport play, and then other, you know, other strategies that we'll talk about, you know, monitoring your load. Now, short-term athlete development is trying to get a short-term goal of like being the best 12-year-old in the area or the best 14-year-old. And that is loading a lot in the beginning and tons of hours of lessons, group, match play, and competition. And guess what? It probably works. If you want your kid to be the best by 12, then do that. Because including my own kid, you're going to beat my kid. The risks that you take are getting hurt and quitting. And if it's worth it for you and you want a short-term goal and that's kind of what you guys decided, and then you're like, well, that's good enough, we don't mind that, then that's just what you have to accept. And I'm not saying it happens to everyone, but you have to accept that we know that over a 3 to 5 year period, it's more likely those kids will not play that sport again. Now, there are some that are resilient, have the really great environment and kind of survive that. And in that group, they could end up being quite successful. And so I don't judge. You know, I've realized, having done just countless media interviews and talking to countless parents and coaches and players, everyone's entitled to how they want to approach their player development pathway.
Yeah, and you know, that's one of the things I've sort of observed in our journey is those kids that were the best at 12 and the 16s, they're still up in the top or they've quit. They're not sort of in the middle of the pack. They're either out of the game or they're still at the very high level. And so it is one of these difficult things where you say where we want to, you know, monitor their load at a young age, but then the kids that are, say, going above that, they're the ones that are more successful. They're getting recognition. They're getting invited to USTA and everything like this, and they're getting all the resources poured into them. And not surprisingly, with that, all that extra attention and that success, they're going to keep, you know, developing and keep improving, or they're going to quit. So it's like you're right. I think it's one or the other. But if you do want to have, you know, the long-term success, short-term success is part of that process too.
Well, and another thing that is coupled with that, it's not just in tennis, it happens in a lot of other sports, and it's been documented well. David Epstein wrote a book. I think he's written a couple of books. I think, your viewers may want to tackle, but you know, it's the, you know, stage of maturity. So early matures versus late matures.
Right.
And so if you have a late mature, you're going to get less opportunities because, you know, you're late to the game with your size, and you're losing on size and some speed and, you know, and strength and those kind of things. I actually, you know, I think our college coaches love the late mature. And I always tell late maturing families, they go, just be patient, dig in there. It's a rough road because you already have the skill set. All you have to do is just grow into it and then not get hurt and then still love it. And then you're going to rock it. And, you know, if you want to play in college, you'll really do well. And we've seen really great examples of the kids who really start peaking at 17 or 18 and not at 12 or 13 and do great in college and really actually be some of the best, you know, some of the best teammates and best athletes because they were a little more patient and, you know, they had to be that. And, you know, I gotta be honest, I know my kids are late matures. And they're smaller and they're like the 15th percentile in everything. But, I think, you know, it's hard, but I'm trying to be patient with them as well too.
Yeah. Well, welcome to my world, but I will tell you that I think you're right. I think coaches love the resilience they see in the player, and we're starting to see the growth happen, and you're dead on. They grow right into that body and they have all the skill set. Let's dive into equipment real quick. Rackets, I think, are a tough thing in tennis. String's a tough thing too. You look at a player that's 10 years old, they're 70 pounds, and the coach recommends a 300-gram racket. I've always wondered what the ratio of weight of the player to weight of the racket ought to be. And a lot of coaches don't know what that should be. And so my own child had a coach recommend a 320-gram racket to a parent that knew nothing. We did it, but it didn't result in an injury. So do you have any recommendations on weight of racket and then go into string as well?
Okay. And so, I'll give you my opinion. I always, where I'm an expert, where I'm not. Whenever I get equipment questions, they say, look, I am not an equipment expert, but like you said, I'm around tennis a lot. And I have my own, kind of general opinions about it. I think the best answer is how it affects your swing speed. Okay, we might have talked about that as well too, and so with weight of the racket and then the type of strings, and so your swing speed is what generates the force. Your racket itself helps optimize that, right? And so if you have a developing kid and has this big heavy racket, and they have to really lug that thing around there, and you see that they cannot generate any swing speed. And they're changing their mechanics to do that, and they have like a little shoulder lag, or they're late behind on their stroke. That swings that's just not going to work, and that's when we end up having to see those kids. When we talk about strings, we have general rules. You know, we like to lower tension. With certain types of injuries, so let the strings do more work. But then you have a different type of swing speed, so that's controlling the ball. So then after you strike it. That's great that it kind of takes off, but now you have to be able to control it, and that takes a lot of upper extremity hand and wrist movement. So it's nice because you don't you can let the record do a bit more work. So that's exactly why, in fact, we have five kids we're going on court this afternoon. We want to keep it at three or four. They're all injured. Almost all of them are upper extremity. They're all high performance kids. And I can't answer that question until I go on personally, until I go on court with them. All of them, they have equipment questions. I say, I need to see what your racket speed looks like. If the racket speed is great, I don't change anything. If the racket speed is slow, then I want to lower, you know, lower the weight, and we'll, you know, and then we'll change strengths based on that. And the racket speed is, you know, too fast. So as for us, like, you know, for us here, like, I know that I can't use a lighter racket, and I have to be cautious of my tension, because too much swing speed for me with a really like younger kids may use lighter rackets is just, I just can't do it with my elbows. My tendons are degenerative. And so it won't tolerate it in a different sense. But I think that's the best answer. See, and most of you, most parents, even if they're not tennis parents, see how their child strikes the ball, and your coach should be able to see how you strike the ball.
And you want the younger players to stay away from polyester strings until maybe they're into puberty.
Well, as a general rule, yeah. You know, perhaps, but. You know, because people think of, you know, wrist and elbow injuries because of that. I don't know that there's a direct correlation. I'm okay based on that. You know, what you do technically is definitely more important for me. Yes. Now, in today's game, the things that I see are number one on the forehand is a lot of loop and a lot of heavy acceleration, which is fine, but also it's heavy early forearm, you know, acceleration and pronation. And so we're not getting through the ball, and the young kids, they see it, and they see the rapid rotation, and so that's what worries me more, actually, than the actual equipment. And on the back end, what we see is a lot of non-dominant wrist pain. We published a thing called backhand wrist, where we're seeing a lot of kids with wrist pain over here. And I'm happy with this one, because actually, no matter how bad it is medically, most of them we're able to help treat on the tennis court. And we're actually seeing a lot of left-hand dominant backhands. They drop the wrist a lot, and they really scoop up the ball. They scoop up here, and it's like common stroke, and they can rip it when it feels good, but boy, is that, you know, that you know, concerns me when they get, you know, some and a lot of pain. They can't hit a backhand for a month or 2 months, and that's a tennis issue. And so, you know, I don't want to name drop, but I was in a cab you know, on the in Rome. I was speaking in Rome, you know, at that time it was like, you know, with Nick Bollettieri and Emilio Sanchez and all these great, and I was steering a cab with Emilio Sanchez, and I asked him, I said, what's this scoop with the change in strokes? I see so much backhand wrist. And he's like, kids have forgotten how to use their right hand on their backhand. He's like, it's gone away. He's like, it's right hand first and then your left hand. And so I've kind of adopted that. I was doing it kind of loosely, but I'm really big on the mechanic change. So again, I think equipment changes play an influence, but the biomechanics of how you strike a ball is actually, I think, the most important. Like, what does it do to change?
And it's just, you know, just another reason why the one-handed backhand is better than the two-handed backhand, right, Robert?
Yes, Scott's a big fan of the one-hander, and his son's got a beautiful one-hander.
So. Is it? I mean, yeah. If you can do it, it's great. It's just not easy to do. I mean, it's great. It's just not easy to do.
Yeah,
Luke's got a lefty one-hander, and it's beautiful. Yep.
Did he hit a one-handed when he was like 10, 11, 12?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, that's great. That's not easy to do.
No,
you talk about patience. I mean, Scott's had to live through a lot of. Hey, just play to his backhand, right?
Yeah, hit it high.
Oh my gosh, it's good for him. I mean,
yeah, he's getting there.
Yeah, he's really accelerating right now. He's playing some really good tennis. So tell me about head heavy headlight. People putting lead tape on their racket. Does the head heavy headlight matter?
Well, you know, it's balance, right? And so, you know, it seems where you balance. I'll go back to this. I actually think most of these things, and I'll tell you, there's this, you know, most of these things make bigger differences as you're farther along in your career. I think early along, I think it's, you know, it's you're still developing. Things are going to change with your body, the way you strike a ball, and I focus on those things. And I'll tell you this, there was one study that actually looked at challenger level players. And they asked them to guess the string tension on their rackets. You know, we all go, and I'm included, like, oh, this racket's like way off. This is, you know, and it's like 2 pounds up. They could only detect the difference to about 8 to 10 pounds. Mm-hmm. And so they weren't very good at it, even though, you know, we're all experts. We feel it and we're like, oh, this feels loose. You know, that was one small study. you know, I think that there's some truth to that. I mean, I think I feel like I would know a 5-pound difference, but I think we make maybe a little bit more of it than in this phase of when we're talking youth athletes, okay, and junior tennis players. You know, I think balance is fine. I don't think it, again, I would look at the stroke. I mean, I think it, if I'm seeing that, you know, that the head is moving around everywhere and I want a little more stiffness and balance at the top, then maybe we'll put a little weight at the top. But I got to be honest with you, we do probably a few hundred on courts a year. I don't think I'm talking about weighting the racket very much throughout the year.
Gotcha. Oh, it's good to know. All right, Scott, you want to jump into a Twitter question?
Yeah, before we get there, yeah, let's go to a Twitter question. Fine. Let's see. It says, is there any test or evaluation kids can do to see if their body is well-suited to tennis?
So there is a thing called the USA High Performance Profile, and whether it's the suitability for tennis or not, I'm a tennis bias. Everyone is suited to play tennis.
Right.
Okay. Like everyone. Right. So, you know,
tennis
is the best sport for everyone. You could be in a wheelchair. You could you could not be able to see. There's actually so if we're talking about, maybe perhaps we should phrase it as, you know, is that what is, you know, how do you assess your child for the optimum, you know, involvement in tennis? And there's a thing called USTA High Performance Profile. You know, I was involved in a publication that Robin Rice and USTA did on several hundred, you know, high level juniors and a few, you know, professional athletes and where we saw differences. And probably the most notable one in that, which is very correctable, is, and this is what we published, you know, on with Robin, is on looking at, you know, just simple things like trunk stability. I mean, this is an assessment of hamstring flexibility, quad flexibility, trunk stability, strength measurements, and very simple things to do. So these are being able to do planks and bridges and those kind of things. And then the associated back pain, the kids who had poor trunk stability had more back pain. That's where we see back stress injury, particularly in that vulnerable period we talked about, that peak height velocity. So I think as far as suitability, you know, if you're wondering, just the best way to find out is have them play tennis, you know, and then, yeah. But then have them play other sport and have them play, you know, like we go to my kid, and I want to brag, but you know, he does group one time a week. Okay. But he plays baseball and he bats like 900 because he can see the ball when it comes, period. That's it. And he plays basketball. He can make every free throw and, you know, but, and he's not the best at either of these other sports, but he's really skilled. And so when he gets on a tennis court, yeah, he may not have hit all the times a week the other kids, but there's a transfer of skill. And so that's how you can find out how they do with other ball movement sports. Soccer is great and basketball is great for lower extremity movement. And I think that's, you can look at the suitability for high performance by seeing that athleticism, which then develops. But try the USC High Performance. It's also publicly available on the USC website.
Okay.
Got it. All right. Another question. Have you seen non-operative procedures for OS trigonum syndrome restore full playing in athletes or any tennis players with this situation?
Well, short of providing specific medical advice, I'll just give you general medical. So osteogonium is when you get a little extra piece in the back part of your ankle. It hurts when you bend forward, called plantar flexion. We actually see it in dancers a bit more, but obviously there's some plantar flexion in tennis. You know, it can be a little bit of a tough problem. The non-operative stuff we do is we try to rehab it, improve the flexibility in the plantar flexion. Sometimes we moderate load. We might put it a little gel insert. And, you know, but if it's a painful osteogonium and it's just stopping your tracks, if we get an MRI and there's like bony edema there, I do diagnostic injections in there, but I don't think they're curative. I don't even put steroid in there. So I, you know, we'll have them, you know, excise that surgically and because the outcomes are likely to be better. If you spend 6 months figuring out whether it's going to be effective or not. And again, let's talk about, we're assuming this is the high risk, you know, I'm sorry, the high performance, group of athletes, and so we want to make dealing with that.
This player, I won't tell you name or anything, about between a 9 and a 10 UTR, about 15 years old.
Yeah, and so, you know, and I think that's a shorter interruption.
And the smaller side too.
Yeah, and that's and again, it's about performance. You don't have to operate on every osteogonium, but I'm talking about if your kid has tried this, you know, a month or two, and they've really tried to. modify their load and training, and you reduce the amount of plantar flexion, running and jumping and everything, and you try to rehab it and put a gel insert, you know, and you just, it's just not getting anywhere. Then you get an MRI, in my opinion, and look to see if there's bony edema, and then consider an excision. If you spend 6 months and you're like out of tennis for that long, it changes your, you know, and then you still have to consider surgery. Then you might end up losing a year, and that's a big change in your developmental pathway. So, and you're talking about a 15-year-old with a 9 or 10 UTR. That's a, you know, that's someone who has a high trajectory, right? So, you know, again, if it's not bothering you, I'll leave everything alone. But if it's stopping you and you can't perform at all, yeah, it's it might be time to take it out with someone who really knows what they're doing.
Quick question. Yeah, just quick question. My son's been dealing with a wrist injury, and we think it's a TFCC type injury. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Anyway, so just curious, is that something that you can play through, or is there some, you know, wrist braces you want to?
I mean, use? Without saying any names, I saw a high performance athlete today with, you know, 15-year-old with TFCC partial tear. We had a long discussion, and, you know, again, not to turn this too much into tennis medicine clinic, but, you know, all these are very individual decisions and answers, right? But it depends on the type of tear, if they have ulnar variants, if there's bony abnormality or not, and how symptomatic they are. And, you know, the spectrum can include anything from ignoring it all and just modifying your load, looking at equipment, and, you know, those types of things, and seeing how you, you know, see how you do on court and modifying strokes and load, to even considering one of two surgeries. One is wrist arthroscopy, but the second one is an ulnar shortening if there's bony involvement, and everything in between, which is, you know, a couple injection types and everything. So that's a tough decision. If it's dominant side, it's a tough one. If it's non-dominant, backhand wrist, a much more, like I told you about, those are, we fix on court. We do some rehab, occasionally inject, but that's an on-court thing. And so we've had really good success with the non-dominant TFCC and ulnar wrist problems. But the dominant side, it's a little tougher because you only have one forehand. You only have one wrist forehand.
Some kids only have one forehand, right?
I actually played a guy in my makeup 5-0 match who hit two hands from both sides, and I've seen, you know, this video of that one kid who has two forehands.
It's interesting.
All right, so last Twitter question: prep and recovery for a tournament. So a lot of students or a lot of young players are playing two singles, two doubles. The singles are lasting 2.5 hours, so 5 hours right there. Then they're playing two doubles, and then that's a Saturday. And then they go to bed, and they wake up on Sunday and do it all over again. And the matches are highly competitive, going to third sets at level ones and level two nationals. First off, I wish that didn't happen, but it is what it is. So what do they need to do to prep, and then what do they need to do to recover on the back end so they can be ready the next day?
Okay, and so I'll back up to the first thing is, let me just say, and this is a very important point for me. I sit on USDA National for Sports Science and been the keynote speaker several times on junior comp committees and voice my concerns about this because, you know, you say there's not much we can do. Well, I actually feel like I need to really provide strong input and feedback. We have heard repeatedly of tour-level players not being happy about back-to-back days of playing intense matches, okay, or finishing late and starting early and all these things. And, you know, God forbid, I mean, when was the last time you had a tour player who played two singles matches in the same day, maybe finish up for a rain out, whatever. So we have to do better at, you know, being more cognizant of that for a really at-risk population. And you're right, these aren't easy matches either, and these are vulnerable kids. So I'm still trying to help and work with that. Now, we experimented with something. We had enough parents who were upset in Southerns, and it's not a national rule yet, but maybe one day it was about heat, but it extended to scheduling that we, and hopefully other sections will do it. And you guys are hopefully influential in, you know, in your area of getting people to kind of push for this. But we created a bit of a, you know, with Maria Cerconi at Southern, we had a little committee and tried to at least allow, you know, every player was allowed a 2-hour rest. They had 12 hours and follow the rules of it. 12 hours. I'm going to quote the changes incorrectly, but there was a maximum on the amount of matches in a day that I can't remember if we could do one or two singles, but but it would not allow two singles, two doubles, 2 days in a row like that. And that does have to change. And it is making me busy in clinic, but it's not good, because when else do you do that? When you go to college, you'll never do that. When you play, if you play professional, you'll never do that. You know, if you play high school, you'll never do it. You know, you rarely will do anything even close to that. It's only the isolating environment of high level junior tennis. So, and it's not great, because we spend so much time control, training load and injury prevention, do everything, do have kids coming off stress injuries in the back. We've done everything right. Coaches, parents, and we go to one tournament and they go and they play 6-7 matches in a weekend and they come back and they're like, and I go, I can't control your environment. So what else can you do now, since that rule isn't changing? But I would urge you to talk to your sections about creating some modifications in my match schedule, particularly when there's like inclement weather and stuff. And it can be done. It happened at Southerns. It can be done in other sections. And I'm happy to kind of, you know, connect those people. So then what can you do? Well, we looked at what's called acute to chronic workload ratios. So avoiding spikes. So when you get a spike in your load, so in other words, if let's just say you have, as an easy number, 10 hours a week of training. I know that's not a high bound, but just as an easy number. And that's what your weekly chronic workload is. And then you have a tournament, and your tournament, you predict, might end up, you know, let's say doubling that workload, right? Or adding, I don't know, 8 more hours, whatever it is. So now you've actually increased, you know, to 18 or 20 hours. If you increase by more than even 30%, your risk of shoulder injuries in tennis players and low back go up. So that's only a 3-hour increase. So then now what you can do as best you can is try to predict as best you can the 2 days before, perhaps, and the 2 days after the tournament, of lowering your load. So instead of like increasing your load right before match play and tournament play, is decreasing it. And I know some people hate me a little, well, you can barely go to the academy, this and that, but this is what recovery is about. And then if you average it out, at least maybe you're doing 12 hours of training over the 2 weeks, and then you accommodate, then, you know, maybe you end up with 8-10 hours of match play, and now you're at, you know, over a 2-week period, you know, you're still only at 24 hours, and that's a 20% increase. And you have to be smart about that. Now, sometimes you might go there and have, you know, maybe you exit early and you end up, you know, not needing to be off as much. At least that's safer for you. In your recovery, maybe you can then resume and start hitting earlier again, so you don't have to make as much accommodation. But I would say the 2 days before, 2 days afterwards. And there's some reasonably enough information that if you have higher workloads 2 days prior, you'll have a higher risk of injury. And then in all endurance events, everyone tapers. You know, distance runners, triathletes, everyone tapers 1 week before and 2 weeks before if it's an Ironman. So I think we need to be better in tennis. We don't do a good job of tapering before and afterwards and allowing the recovery.
Well, and this is a conversation Scott and I have had a lot, because my own child just can't make it through a full tournament. And I shouldn't say can't, does, but more often doesn't than does. And a part of that was a year ago at 14, he's 89 pounds and 5'1", right? And now he's finally hit a growth spurt. So he's having to work a lot harder to hit every ball than the 6'1", 180-pound kid across the net. And so I agree with you. But a tournament like Zonals, where it was one singles, one doubles every day, and that was it, he would have his best results.
Love it. Exactly.
They eliminated Zonals. But then they eliminated Zonals, right? So
For now. I've complained about all of this. You know, and then that's for now. They're reshaping it. They're going to bring it back. They're very big on team tennis, as far as I understand it, USTA.
Good. Well, yeah, it makes sense. So
never should have been eliminated, but a scooter's coming back.
Yeah, I don't know all those details.
I heard that a lot too.
By the way, what you're describing, I heard that a lot. Go ahead.
All right. So nutrition.
Robert, real quick. So I guess the thing I want to just sort of try to understand is, you know, if you have a 64 player tournament, that means you've got 6 matches. And you've got to do it in a weekend, maybe Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or Saturday, Sunday, Monday. You're sort of stuck with 2 matches a day. How do we get around that?
Yeah. So we can't do anything to. I'm not going to say anything to offend any parents, kids, coaches, tournament directors. Okay, but we looked at this 15 plus years ago. The tournaments were different. They had super nationals then, but we looked at all 4 super nationals at all the age divisions and looked when kids pulled out of tournaments. Okay, it was like a more than 100,000 matches we looked at. And so if you got to the, it was two and a half times more likely to pull out of a tournament in the main draw at a national event if you were beyond your fourth match. And so it wasn't like backdraw flu and kids were pulling. It was main draw matches. And so once you get beyond four, and that's once a day, right? So there is a cumulative fatigue that's only so much that each kid can tolerate. They're still kids, right? And that's not that different than the tour, right? I mean, that's kind of where people really start fatiguing it, you know. And that's so the broader question is, and this is a sensitive topic, is should these tournaments have such large draw sizes aside from the financial part of running a tournament? And so. And parents don't like to hear that they can't get into a tournament. Well, you know what? Who else doesn't like to hear that? Is, you know, a player who's ranked 147 and can't meet the cutoff for a 250 event. You know, and you know, so it happens. That's actually how tennis works at the other level. So you have to find your level of competition. So the actual solution would be do more compass draws, more. You know, you'd have to smaller draw size and do it, you know, or do team events like zonals. And what you want is great match play and great competition. There's no sense in, you know, getting a huge draw, having several matches that someone gets killed or someone wins easily. And then, but you still have to go through the whole process, hit and da-da, do all this stuff to get to your good matches. And, you know, and so you're either a big winner or you're a big loser, but to say you were just at the event, that's how I look at it. Now, that's a big change for a lot of people. And I know people don't like to hear that, but if you put the athlete, the junior tennis player, at the center of it all, that would be how you'd center it, right? You'd get great matches and not overload them for no reason.
Okay.
Yeah, makes sense. All right, supplements. We only got 10 minutes. Supplements. Questions came in from parents about is collagen, does it even work for tendons and all kinds of injuries? Creatine, protein. Those type of things. Are there supplements that you would recommend?
Yeah, let's go backwards and start with protein, creatine, and then collagen, right? So the nutritional changes are the best things. The same things I talk to tour-level players are the same things I talk to, you know, 14-year-olds. So you optimize your nutrition. Paige Love works with both tours and you know, WATP, WTA. She's in Atlanta, fortunately. But, you know, how you modify your diet with resistance training. So as an example, protein, you need to get 1.5 grams per kilogram per day. Roughly, if you're 70 kilograms, 150 pounds, that's 100 grams a day. Not easy to do. That's 20 to 30 grams in a chicken breast. You do everything you can to do that. And you combine that with strength training. And so I can tell you, and I can say this because I'm Indian, there's a lot of young Indian tennis players that come from not the best genes, and they are going to get behind, and some of them are vegetarian, and they're going to get behind the eight ball because their skill set's good, but their physicality is not there. And so that dietary thing has to start as early as possible. And I don't even say I'm good at it with my kids, okay? But so that's number one. And then the carbohydrate, and this is a very brief nutritional kind of like a crash course. And then so that's to build muscle mass, okay? And performance is, and I think most everyone knows it, but I don't think most everyone does it, is your carbohydrate load. So it has to be like in you. So, you know, that it's the data is 4 hours before your event where you max load your carbs. You get your 100, 200 grams or more of carbs, heavy carb meal, protein before that as well for long term, right? So it goes carbs and protein. And then immediately, immediately after the match, within the first 30 minutes, you should be, you know, throwing something down immediately afterwards. This is separate to your fluid and hydrations, but. And if a match lasts longer than an hour, you should have a different bottle for each set almost. Like you can start with even just water in the first set, but soon after that, you should start with, you know, some, you know, I don't know, Gatorade, Powerade, but mixed carbohydrate electrolyte solution. So it has carbs in it too. And then if you're a heavy sweater, you should add more salt by the third set. So each subsequent, you know, hour basically or set you're adding on. And then your recovery is you got to load completely. I mean, it's nutritional. Get out of the heat and start rolling out in every body part and just optimize that environment as much as possible. Then if you go, and that happens over long periods. And if you're in your, you know, in your fitness time, you're working on resistance training in supervised settings. So you build mass with proper nutrition. Creatine, there is efficacy in creatine. But you know, it basically, the simplest way to put it is maybe it shortens recovery so that you can lift better. That's why football players use it, okay? Do I think tennis players need to do that for recovery to build mass beyond what I recommend for protein? Not really, not tennis players. This is kind of kind of short term for recovery for guys who are in the gym a lot to build mass. So I'm not so sure creatine is what you need for a tennis player. And the last thing is collagen. I haven't seen any evidence that collagen, tendon stuff, first of all, isn't a huge problem for most kids. And I have some that are 14 to 16 and 17 with tendon issues, but taking something orally isn't going to help that. And I haven't seen any evidence that oral collagen is going to improve tendon health. So I would rank it in reverse and really emphasize the nutritional, what I call manipulations.
Got it.
Well, is that too much information? Because that's a lot.
This is exactly what we want. Look, I'm going to tell you, the reaction we're going to get from this podcast is, can you have him on more?
For sure. Yep.
So in the last, I want to take 4 minutes on physical fitness. So weights, when can they lift weights? When should they start lifting weights? Pre-puberty, during puberty, post-puberty. And then I want you to tell people how they can find you. So if there's a parent out there, they live in, say, Chicago, and their child's injured and they want to bring them to see you, or if they're in Atlanta where you are. So tell us about lifting pre, during, and post, and then how they can get in contact with you.
Sure. I'll just do the easy part. It's tennismedicine@emoryhealthcare.org. tennismedicine@emoryhealthcare.org. Tony is my Emory tennis athletic trainer. He's awesome. And he coordinates in town, out of town. He's on court. He has the best job in the world. It just doesn't get paid enough. He's on court all week long at all of our academies. All these kids try to stay healthy. And we don't charge any of the academies. We don't charge for any of the on-court stuff. We see so many tennis players every year in the clinic. You know, that's where I'm stuck, being in the office. But I get on court, with him once a week. So, and he can help coordinate any questions or anything else, as best as we can, wherever you are. And then as far as, physical, you asked about physical fitness, right? And resistance.
Yeah. Parents are wanting to know when can their kids lift.
So I learned a lot after I was already a double board certified physician to help at a tennis academy who had high performance program. And I recommended them to have a fitness and off court tennis specific conditioning. And then the owner of the club looked at me and said, well, can you do it? And I said, I'm a sports doctor and I don't have time to do this. And then he begged. So I learned, I did it for, I forget, like 10 years and just went out myself and actually learned a lot that you don't actually learn in medical school. And what you should know is that you can do a lot. First of all, resistance training in a supervised setting is safe and healthy at any age, but it has to be progressive and done properly. So it starts with body weight. So most tennis players and pre-adolescents can do body weight, but simple things, planks and bridges, and even literally sit-ups and push-ups. And then you add Swiss balls and more trunk stability. Then you add medicine balls and you kind of work your way up. So if they're doing things properly, regardless of their age, it's more how they do it. You can add resistance training as weightlifting. If they can do a great squat with their hands up, coming down, then you add a bar, and then if they could do a great squat like that in a supervised setting, you're okay to do it. Do I think tennis players going through adolescent, most of them need to build mass? No, but they need to build strength and stability. So they may not be able to, they don't need to max out or anything like that. Low level weights, lots of reps, and great form. And you can start, but supervised is not, and I've said this before, it's not 14-year-old Jimmy who, used to lift because his brother played football. It's about a qualified person or maybe a very informed parent watching and making sure they're doing it properly in supervised settings. And so those academies that have, and we have a lot of, we're fortunate to have some really good strength and conditioning folks and performance folks tied to academies. And some actually, quite honestly, there's some coaches who are really good as well too, or they've taken Mark Kovacs's course, IITPA. I'm fine with whoever it is that's making sure they're doing it that properly and at the right sequencing of it, right? So you have to demonstrate, just like in tennis and everything else, the right sequencing.
Yeah, makes total sense.
One last question, since we do have maybe two more minutes here. Right now we're in December. Some people don't have indoor options, like say in Atlanta, there's not a lot of indoor. And we play some tournaments in Atlanta this time of year and it gets really cold and What's your thoughts on when is it too cold to play? And if you are playing and it's below, say, 30 degrees, what should you do to prevent any injuries?
I moved from Chicago. We played indoor nine months a year, and I didn't like that,
right,
actually.
Right.
You know, but you know, when is it too cold? So when is the USTA rule different than when you do? I think some of the weather I've seen, some of these match days are you know, quite unbelievable. So one way to get around is don't schedule tournaments in December and January outdoor. Well, could be an answer.
Well, you know, but, yeah, I mean, my son played in Rome in March, and it was 25 degrees.
I remember that. I remember seeing videos of that, yeah. So, yeah. You know, when do I think it's unsafe? I mean, to be honest, like, is it unsafe? No, because we play other sports in weather like that. And, you know, is it terribly unsafe for a conditioned athlete to play in 25 or 30 degree weather? Probably not, you know, unless you have asthma or breathing difficulties with cold air and all that. Is it brutal for a tennis player because you got to use your hands, and does it affect your performance and all the other stuff? Yeah. And, you know, I've never really seen anyone have like hypothermia or heard of it from a tennis event. I've covered some very cold tennis state championships in Chicago, but you know, in fact, to be honest, like, you know, you cover Chicago Marathon, when you're out there longer, you generate some heat. The lower every like degree or 5 degrees that went lower, there was lower number of people coming in to the tent for problems. When the heat went up, it was more. So the more you're out there in the cold weather, you generate heat. And so I don't necessarily think that's a health risk, but I do think that it makes it incompatible with good tennis below freezing.
True.
You know, I think it's very difficult to have a good outcome in tennis, and it's a really uncomfortable environment. But no, you know, yes. And I'm pretty much a straight shooter. Like, yeah, I wouldn't want to play out there, but yeah, below freezing, I think should be your cutoff. That's our USTA rule is, you know, if you're below 32, you shouldn't be playing a tennis match outdoors.
Yeah, my thought was that maybe the ball would get harder or compress and it'd be harder on your arm, but that's not the case.
Perhaps, but things do warm up. Yeah, perhaps that could be true, but yeah, I mean, again, like, I would love to cancel all events that were that cold. I think I remember that Rome event because it was a fluke, and then I remember seeing videos and stuff, and we canceled our match. I remember we canceled our matches. And then I still saw all those. I was like, man, how are they playing? But yeah, it dipped
how
low.
Are they watching? I mean, we had to sit there and watch that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I feel worse for the parents. So, yeah, and their kids, you know, but.
Yeah,
but,
by the second changeover, they were out of their sweatshirts. I mean, they were fine. But.
Oh, they're pulling their pants off, wearing shorts, and they're
the kids
fine.
Were, the it's kids do it. Like I said, it's not a health risk for the kids. Yeah, it would drive me nuts. Yeah, my kids would do that too.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Janathy, thank you so much for coming on. We know your time's valuable. You probably are headed into clinic right now. Thank you. Thank you again. And we hope to have you back soon.
Oh, absolutely. Well, actually, I'm headed on court. I got about five kids we're seeing this afternoon on court. So it's my favorite time, Thursday afternoon, to do that. So great having you guys send out proper messages to parents. And we got to keep doing that. And I think we'll hopefully keep developing a lot of really good players in this country.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye, guys.
See ya.
Bye.
Giving me wind and rain, you're some kind of butterfly. Baby, you give me fear diner. You whip up my appetite. Don't leave me here high and dry. Oh, I don't wanna jinx it, baby. Can't treat myself at the spine. Just treat your body to mine. Maybe you give me ice and fire. You're giving me wind and rain. You're some kind of butterfly. Maybe you give me midnight. You whip up my appetite. Don't leave me here high and dry. Oh, but I don't wanna jinx it, baby. Let's not get.